talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Good morning. This is the Weird Movie Geeks podcast. Today is March 20th. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
And I'm Jim Tudor.
Jim Tudor has joined us. Jim's joined us several times. This is like your third or fourth or fifth appearance on the Weird Movie Geeks podcast. Jim Tudor writes for Zeke Film.
Yep. Yeah. I run Zeke Film.
That's right. Yeah. And you used to write for the Twitch Film, but you guys changed your name to
Screen Anarchy.
Screen Anarchy. Why'd you change your name from Zeke to...
I mean, from...
Twitch to Screen Anarchy.
Well, that was not my decision. I'm merely a featured critic at Screen Anarchy, formerly known as Twitch Film. Uh-huh. And there was another website called Twitch that emerged in the meantime and became very popular in the video game world. So,
oh, really? So you want to be confused.
Yeah, and they tried to figure out how to fight that for a while, and then they just said, you know what, forget it. Let's just change it. So it's changed, because film is antiquated anyway. Let's go with screen. It's like that's not going anywhere. There will always be screens.
Yeah, I must say with Zeke Film, when I hear that, I think of Jed Clampett and his buddies going down to the to the Bijou and Buck Tussle.
That's what we're going for, Jim.
Oh, really?
No, I
don't. All right, well, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk about the top 12 of the box office over the weekend. La La Land, which won Best Picture for, 2.5 minutes?
Yes.
And then was robbed. Only made a measly $500,000. If it had won Best Picture, it would have probably made a lot more than that.
Well, Moonlight's not in the top 12.
That's for sure. La La Land played over the High Point for 5 weeks.
Wow, in the main room there?
Yeah, in the big theater. Actually, it's still over on the back.
So it's fine, really. They're doing fine.
Yes. Number 11 was Lion, which did not win any Oscars. It made $0.8 million. Before I Fall, which I reviewed a couple weeks ago at WeirdMovieGeeks.com. Did you see that, Jim Tudor?
Absolutely not.
Okay, that starred Zoe Deutsch. And I actually
gave it said with fervor.
I gave it a good review. It wasn't too bad. That was number 10 with $1 million. John Wick is still in the top 10. I haven't seen that. Did you see that one, Jim? John Wick 2?
John Wick 2. I saw John Wick.
Oh, okay.
But I want to see John Wick 2.
Oh, okay. That made $1.2 million. Mm-hmm. Hidden Figures is still in the top 10. It made $1.5 million.
Did you ever make it through that, Tom?
Yeah, I did. I watched it one night last week. Hey, it was actually pretty good.
Yeah, it's fine. It's my 9-year-old daughter. It's like inspired her now to be a scientist. She's written a paper about Katherine Johnson. She got to see Katherine Johnson get wheeled out on the Oscars. That was magical.
There you go.
Yes.
It's a good movie for kids.
All right, number seven, Belco Experiment debuted at number 7. It's not in that many theaters. It's only, I think, in 4 theaters here in St. Louis. Yeah. And I can't believe I didn't see it. I've been looking forward to this movie for months.
Yeah, I was at a screening Saturday morning at the Galaxy. It was not there. I was hoping to catch a little bit of it or something.
So I guess we'll have to wait till next. I will see it this week. I guess we'll review that. Well, we're not going to have a show next Monday, by the way.
No.
So I'll review that in 2 weeks. Lego Batman movie is still at number 6 with $4.7 million. The Shack. Did anybody see The Shack?
No,
nobody saw The Shack.
They didn't show it.
That's a Christian movie. That Sam. I almost says Sam Waterston. What's that guy's name?
Sam Worthington.
Sam Worthington.
Yes. Sam Mr. Worthington. Avatar.
Yeah.
Yes, and Octavia Spencer.
That's right.
Yeah. And
she's everywhere.
She got two movies in the top 10. My goodness.
The Shack.
Busy lady.
And she's also in this new one with Chris Evans.
Gifted. Yes. I had a friend of mine over the weekend wondering if I had a screener of The Shack, and I was like, no, we don't get them through the year. No. Sorry, they're not going to send that to us.
They tend not to share those faith-based films with critics.
Yeah. Occasionally they do, but they didn't with this one. Okay, let's move on. Number 4 was Get Out with $13.2 million.
Hanging tight. Top 5.
And still. Number 3 was Logan with $17.5 million. Mm. Kong Skull Island was number 2. That was number 1 last week. Last week it made like $65 million. This week it made a mere $28.9 million because the big behemoth... There's no stopping. It's like that big boulder in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Beauty and the Beast made a whopping $170 million.
Let's wonder that that Alabama drive-in banning didn't hurt the box office. I was surprised that it would make that much.
Yeah.
Well, I have to point out the big boulder in Raiders of the Lost Ark does eventually come to an abrupt stop.
Yeah.
You know,
it's ain't gonna stop
like
soon.
Indiana Jones himself who keeps going.
And I only gave it sort of a middle of the road review, so I'm surprised it did as well as it did.
Well, it's
I guess if I had given it a good review, it would have done better.
Yeah, well, it's only at about 71%. I should say only, but it's do a little better at the Rotten Tomatoes, but it's only in the low 70s.
It's quite flawed, in my opinion. We'll hash that out between us here in just a second.
Mm.
In fact, we are going to start reviewing movies. We're going to review that. We're going to do a quick review of Kong Skull Island. Although Kong seems like old news all of a sudden.
And he's just number two.
And we've got a few other ones. Zookeeper's Wife, Land of Mine, and Sense of an Ending. But let's go ahead and start with Beauty and the Beast. I reviewed Beauty and the Beast for WeAreMovieGeeks.com last week.
Again.
Who said that?
Hello.
You can talk.
Hello, of course. It's all he ever does.
How lovely to make your acquaintance.
Want to see me do a trick?
When the last petal falls.
I gave it 2.5 out of 5 stars, so I was kind of like right up the middle with Beauty and the Beast. My biggest problem was with the three leads, especially young Emma Watson. I just thought she was miscast. When they announced 1.5 years ago that she was going to be playing Belle, I said, she is not Belle. I'm not going to like young Miss Watson as Belle, and I proved myself right. I did not like I think she's a decade too old for the role. I just think she's sort of serious. She doesn't seem to... There's not a whole lot of joy with her character. I just didn't buy her as Belle at all.
Well, I disagree. I don't believe Belle is the same age as Ariel. Ariel, for instance, in The Little Mermaid, is supposed to be about 16 or 17. I always thought of Belle as being college age.
Me too.
And I think that Emma can still, at least for another year or two, pass for college age. Yeah, a woman in her early 20s. So she's only 27. So I was able to buy her as Belle in this.
But she didn't seem happy. I didn't really buy into the love affair between her and Beast.
Well, she's not happy for a lot of it. I mean, that she lives in a repressive place. I mean, they get on to her for actually trying to teach a little girl how to read.
Belle. She doesn't have the spirit that Belle had in the animated film.
No, no, you know, Belle is not Snow White or any of the other princesses. You know, she's feisty and she's fights for herself.
Yeah, but she's not like Hermione. I mean, everybody associates Miss Watson as Hermione. Hermione was, you know, a team player that teamed up with all these other Harry Potter and his buddies. Where Belle is kind of a loner. Belle needs to be in a room with a book and she's perfectly happy. So they're not similar characters, but I think Miss Watson sort of played them in the same way. What do you think, Jim T?
I loved the movie. I really did. I thought it was fantastic, and I was very skeptical because I'm a big fan of the 1991 version and the 1946 French version, by the way. So this version, which...
And that actress was 31, by the way.
Right, exactly. Name. So, you know, and... this one is this is a tough remake to nail. That when Disney announced they were doing this, it was kind of like, oh gosh, guys, you know, you should stick to the live action adaptations of your animated classics that aren't amazing already.
Yeah.
You know,
I said that in my review. I said that the Beauty and the Beast is sort of like the Wizard of Oz for you know, more than one generation.
So you got to
be careful.
Well, I think with Jungle Book, for instance, doing live action adaptation works better because they're dealing with animals. Here, they're dealing with these really fantastical creatures.
Yeah,
and I think they actually work better as a Celdron 2D animated figures.
Yeah, there were a few entire scenes where it's nothing but inanimate objects. Well, that are animated, of course, talking to each other, like the candle and the clock and all Cogsworth and all these guys. And that was those scenes. I kind of became aware that I was watching something artificial. But I'll tell you what. I mean, there are scenes here that they just had to nail. I was happy with Be Our Guest. I was sitting through the movie going, when we get to Be Our Guest, that'll make or break this thing. And for me, they pulled it off. And then, of course, the ballroom dance and the yellow dress. I mean, this movie has to be big and ornate and beautiful and lush and just right.
And it wasn't, in my opinion. But I know what you mean. It was some sort of you know, CGI overkill, I think.
Really?
Yeah, and I didn't care for the redesign of some of the characters. For instance, yeah. Lumiere, I thought that his face was so tiny in it, and in the animated film, his face was actually part of the
sure.
candle, and it could be very, very expressive.
Right.
And I was seeing pixels dance around it.
I had seen pixels dance around on the Beast's face. I didn't care for the way that the Beast was portrayed. You had this actor, Dan Stevens, and he was fine, but he was obviously acting with these little balls glued to his face. And then by the time rendered it to digital, it looked sort of fake. It didn't look real. I think Kong and Kong Skull Island's face looked more real than the Beast's face. I wish they would have just put some makeup on Dan Stevens and let the guy act. I think they just overdid it a little bit with some of the
sometimes the makeup can be a little restrictive. You know, and unfortunately, all actors aren't like John Hurt, who was able to emote so well through the Elephant Man makeup.
Yeah. He has to sing.
It seemed like he was just kind of cumbersome in it. He just seemed kind of too bulky in it to me. I think the trouble is Dan Stevens is not as good an actor as Glenn Keane, the animator who handled the Beast in the animated film.
Yeah.
The Beast in that film is completely expressive, at times he seems light as a feather too. Mm. So he was able to handle the bulk and how the Beast should move.
Yeah, and my third casting problem was Gaston. Now these are the three leads, and I didn't really like any of them. Gaston, I said in my review, needs to tower over everybody, and I've seen Beauty and the Beast at the Muni. I've seen it at Disney World. And they always get some great big old 6'6" guy that looks like Little Abner or something, just towering over everybody. Everybody's looking up to him. And they've got the Luke Evans. Luke Evans is 6 foot tall. I'm taller than Luke Evans. And he's on the same plane as everybody else during all of the sequences. And it doesn't make him as much of a formidable foe against Beast when those two finally meet up. It seems like Beast could just squash this guy.
They couldn't find another Hemsworth brother somewhere.
Yeah.
They could...
Well, the wife and I were talking on the way home, and I said, I think 20 years ago, Hugh Jackman would have been perfect for this part. And I said, well, who else out there is big and tall that could have pulled this off? And my wife said, maybe Dwayne Johnson. I don't think
we know he can sing.
Yeah, he can sing. I don't think I don't think it would have worked with Dwayne Johnson. But there's got to be somebody else, some big old giant tall guy that can sing out there that they could have put in this.
I thought Luke handled his tunes very well, though.
I don't think his voice had quite the bombast that Gaston needs.
Well, yes, my favorite thing is the tone between the real world and the fairy tale that this movie has to walk that line. Mm-hmm. There's that part in the movie, and everything hinges on this, where the horse, the dad has been captured by the Beast, and his horse goes back to the village and finds Belle. Belle goes up and talks to the horse and says, "Where's father? Take me to him." And then cut to her on the horse riding to the castle, and he takes her to the castle.
Yeah.
Now, everything's contingent on this, and of course, we're in a live action adaptation. In the animated version, this is all entirely plausible, of course, talking to the horse and the horse knowing what to do. In the real movie, we're looking at a real horse. It's kind of funny to me. It's like the way they handle that in this movie is so fast. It's just like, get through it and people won't notice.
Yeah, I felt a lot of the movie.
But it was the right way to do it. I liked that.
It was 45 minutes longer than the animated film, but some of it seemed like filler. There was three new songs. There was one that Beast sang by himself about the 90-minute mark that I thought was pretty good. The other two, I've seen it twice now. We're not very memorable. Bill Condon directs this, and he's the perfect director if you want to play it safe. I would have kind of liked to have seen something a little different. Think outside the box, something a little quirkier. Maybe Baz Luhrmann or somebody could have tackled this and done something a little bit different. It just seems so predictable the way it was.
Certainly would have beefed up the LeFou character, I'm sure.
Yeah. But Bill Condon plays the LeFou character. Say, everybody knows he's gay by now, but there's these three characters that are Gaston's toadies, and there's the scene at the end where the wardrobe fights them, and then all of a sudden they're wearing dresses, and two of them run off screaming in horror, and then the third guy kind of looks down, and he's happy he's in a dress, and that's a great scene. And then at the very end, they're dancing in the ballroom, and LeFou and this guy you know, all of a sudden they're arm in arm dancing, and that's a great shot too. But it cuts away from that, like you know, there's like 1 second they could have just held on that a couple of more beats, maybe had these two guys look at each other. But no, they wanted to play it safe, and they cut away, wow, which was too bad.
Well, if they were really playing it safe, they wouldn't have LeFou, you know, booting over Gaston like he does.
That was handled pretty well, and I kind of like the way that just really totally defined his character right from the beginning. He's doing that.
I thought Josh Gad was very funny.
And he's a great Disney character.
Yeah. Sometimes Josh Gad could be a little cloying, a little obnoxious, you know, with the cutesy stuff. But here he found the right beat just about, except he's you know, camping it up quite a bit in the Gaston number. Yeah. A little much. but this film also reiterates the tragic genius of Howard Ashman. Because, boy, those songs hold up. Yeah. They're terrific.
Yeah.
You know, and they're just so clever. The lyrics are fantastic. And you're just like, boy, I wish that guy were still around churning out great tunes, you know. It'd be great.
Absolutely.
All right, so Jim T, how many stars would you have given it out of five if you reviewed it for Weird Movie Geek?
Oh, probably four and a half perhaps. I don't know. Depends. Yeah.
Okay, how many would you have given it, Jim?
Out of five,
B?
Maybe about 3.5.
All right, at least. Jim would have given it 3.5. Jim T would have given it 4.5, and I gave it 2.5. So
all over the place.
But you know what? It doesn't really. Nobody cares what I think. This movie made $170 million over the weekend, which is about what it cost. It's going to continue to make money, and it's going to reach $1 billion by tomorrow.
So it's like the second highest March grosser. It was the first one, Batman and Superman, last year? That's probably. That came out the March 25th last year.
All right, let's move on. Yeah. All right, last week's number one movie was Kong Skull Island.
Yeah. We don't belong here.
But the devils live below us. I call them skull crawlers.
Why?
Because it sounds neat.
Okay.
Look, I just made that name up. I'm trying to scare you.
I'm fine calling them that. Are you cool with it?
Yeah, that seems like a good
name. I like the name.
I reviewed Kong Skull Island for WeirdMovieGeeks.com, and I gave it 5 out of 5 stars. I loved everything about Kong Skull Island, including its imperfections. They were just endearing. Kong Skull Island did really well. It made $66 million opening weekend. It fell short this weekend because of Beauty and the Beast, so it does kind of seem a little bit like old news now. But Kong Skull Island's great. I saw it again over the weekend in IMAX 3D, and the 3D is pretty amazing, especially in that helicopter, that big helicopter battle near the beginning. What do you think, Jim T, of Kong Skull Island?
It's fine. It's fine. It's you know, same old gripe people level out these sorts of movies that, you know, the monsters were so much more fun when they were clay armatures. Now it's a digital spectacle. There's something missing. That said, there's a lot wrong with this movie, but doggone it, it's a big monster movie. It just wears its stupidity and goes for it, and it is what it is.
What's great about it, Jim, this is my frustration with that Godzilla film from a couple of years ago with Bryan Cranston, and especially with Pacific Rim. They had all the monster battles practically in darkness.
Ooh.
I think Pacific Rim, one battle had rain, you know, had like a thunderstorm going on. And here it's all, you can see everything. It's in full, right in your face. Yeah. And one of our colleagues complained that, well, action fans will love it, but they'll be missing Kong. They won't see enough Kong.
Plenty of
what?
Kong.
There's lots. You see him in the first five minutes, for God's sake.
It is a serious action film. It's dark. It's violent. It's got this great character played by Sam Jackson. Who's this director?
Jordan Voight.
Roberts.
Jordan Voight.
You know, Spielberg had directed this, he would have found an excuse to put like 2 14-year-olds on one of the helicopters
Spielberg
or something like that.
Did direct this. It was called The Lost World.
And he had a couple of teenagers in there. I like the way this stuck
and
with the adults.
And I remember you were concerned beforehand, Tom, about the John C. Reilly character. It turns out he works.
No, he totally did. Yeah, I was concerned about him in the trailer, because in the trailer he sort of pops up mugging and he seems like he's walked in from a different movie in the trailer. But in the final film, he works just fine. In fact, that character is really good, and I really love the little epilogue that was shot on 8mm film. That was sort of charming.
It's very enjoyable.
You know,
yeah.
Michael Keaton originally had that role.
That's what I heard.
So he dropped out at the last minute.
But yeah, I did take it in as you did on IMAX 3D after seeing the original press screening in 2D, and boy, it's really super in 3D. If you can spring for that, definitely go. If not, every theater is running Beauty and the Beast in 3D, then go see this in IMAX 3D. Definitely.
Yeah.
I'm not doing that.
It's super exciting. I think it's my favorite movie I've seen so far this year. But I'm a big King Kong guy.
There's some good movies.
It's a worthy addition to the Kong canon.
Yeah, there's some good movies so far this
Anybody
year.
Want to say anything else about Kong before we move on?
He's king.
How does he eat? I mean,
see him eat in it.
The island's not that big, and you know, a creature 100 feet tall would have to do a lot of eating to maintain himself throughout the day. I mean, we see him eat a squid, but there's not that many other big creatures around for him to eat.
And what do those 500,000 critters in the Great Wall eat?
You know, well,
they all look pretty healthy.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, again,
true.
You can't look for little things in a movie.
You're right. It runs on pixels.
But I wanted some calamari at the concession stand for Kong. Sure.
All right, let's move on. Jim saw Land of Mine, which is about landmines, I think. And did you review it for WeirdMovieGeeks.com? I did not read your review. It's how many stars?
I gave it 4 out of 5 stars. I thought it's really strong. It was up.
Movies about landmines tend to be a little intense.
Yeah, a little, you know, scary. But yeah, this was nominated for the best foreign film Oscar. It lost to Salesman, but boy, this is really strong. It's a sort of an unknown story. You talked about Hidden Figures being an unknown story. At the end of World War II in Denmark, they decided that they would use their prisoners of war to find all the hundreds and thousands of landmines that the Germans had placed on the coast of Denmark, because Germany thought that this is where the Allied invasion would be coming. So this is about a tough, hard sergeant who's assigned a bunch of these POWs, and these guys are kids. They're not even shaving age. They look to be 13 or 14 at the most. And he says, you know, you find
I was
all
shaving
the,
at 13.
You find all the wives. Well, you're more manly than most, Tom. Yes, yes. At every last interview I've ever covered with hair, it's a Gaston song, right? Yes.
But, he uses antlers in all his decorating.
I'm especially good at expectorating.
That's right. But these poor kids, they have to crawl along the beach and poke around with a stick to see if they can find the mine. And then they have to carefully dig it out. And
it must be a pretty long stick.
Oh, yeah. Well, like I say, it's not long enough. But the trouble is also that they're starving. There's at the end of the war, there's a lack of food. And, of course, they aren't top priority, so they're dealing with that. And, of course, this Danish sergeant hates the Nazis. But somehow he starts feeling sort of paternal to these kids. And it's really interesting to see this bond sort of form. I was afraid that in writing my review, it might sound like I was sympathizing with the Nazis in this, but I had imagined in my head that at the end of the war, they were just scooping up everybody that they could hold a rifle, no matter what their age.
Yes. And I want to make this clear. Jim is not a Nazi sympathizer.
That's right. I'm just like Captain America. Boy, I'll just punch him right in the face.
You're a humanitarian.
All right, let's cut to the chase. What's so good about this movie?
I think the whole tension, you talked about them defusing the mind, the whole performances by this young cast, especially, and the older cast, too, this guy playing the sergeant is terrific in it. And if you can handle it, I heard several of our fellow critics saying, it's a great film. I never want to see it again, though. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a great look at sort of an untold story of World War II. So I recommend it if it pops up on your streaming
service.
The
Hurt Locker was about, mind diffusers or bomb diffusers. There's been other films. 10 Seconds to Hell with Jack Palance. That was about bomb diffusers.
There was one that won Best Foreign Language Film like 15 years ago where a guy was laying on a landmine the entire movie.
That's
what was that called?
I don't remember, but I saw it.
That's going to bother us now for the rest
of
the show.
What one thing they find is when they're digging out these mines, sometimes they doubled up on them. I mean, at one point, they're digging up and says, no, stop, there's a mine underneath, and it's too late for one of the kids, of course.
All right, so Jim highly recommends Land of Mine, and I'm going to do a quick review of The Zookeeper's Wife.
No one knows how hard it is. You can never tell who your enemies are or who to trust.
The Zookeeper Wife opens on the 31st, but since we won't be here next Monday, I'll go ahead and do a quick review. Zookeeper's Wife stars Jessica Chastain as the Zookeeper's Wife. She and her husband, played by Johan Hindelberg, have a zoo in Warsaw, Poland, and guess what? The Nazis come in and they take over Warsaw, and they take over their zoo, and the Nazis are led by Ruhl, what's his first name, from Rush.
Oh, gosh.
That actor.
Again,
he was in Inglourious Bastards.
Oh, gosh, yes. So that's a good one.
Rule is his last name. Anyway, he's a good actor. But
Daniel
Rule, that's his name.
Oh, Daniel. Or
maybe
Baron Zemo from Captain America Civil War. Yeah, that's
okay.
right. Yeah.
Anyway, he comes. He's They keep identifying him as Hitler's zoologist. Oh, look, it's Hitler's zoologist, which I think would make a great name for a band or something. Anyways, he comes into the zoo and he's real evil because he's a Nazi. And there's this one shot where there's this, you know, beautiful American bald eagle on display. He goes, shoot that eagle and have him stuffed and put in my office. So they do. They shoot this poor eagle. And the next shot, you see the stuffed eagle in the foreground while, you know, he's in the back talking on the phone to Hitler or something. In case you can't tell, this movie's not too subtle. The Nazis come in and they take all the zoo animals and they ship them off to Berlin so they can be in Hitler's zoo. And they make this couple that are running this zoo turn their zoo into a hog farm so they can raise hogs to feed the Nazis that have taken over Warsaw. But what they do is this woman, I wish I could remember their characters' names, but the husband goes into the ghettos of Warsaw to get trash to feed the pigs. But what he does is he takes these Jews that they're going to haul off to the concentration camps, the ones that are sort of in a waiting station there, and he hides them under the trash that they're going to feed the pigs. So then they take these Jews back to the zoo and they hide them in the pens and places like that. It's not a bad movie at all. It's okay as far as Holocaust movies. It's kind of a mid-range Holocaust movie. It's not as bad as, you know, Boy in the Striped Pajamas or Jacob's Liar.
Jacob the Liar. Yes.
I'm trying to. There's not been a whole lot of bad Holocaust movies, but there have been a few. It's not as bad as those, but it's no
Schindler's List.
The Pianist or the Schindler's List or Ilsa, She Will Be the SS. I think those are the top three.
Oh, sure.
It's somewhere in the middle. It should be called, I don't know why it's called The Zookeeper's Wife. It should be called The Zookeeper and His Wife, because it's really the husband who's really putting himself in danger, and he's really the idea guy. He's the one who has the idea of saving these Jews. She uses her sexuality to sort of seduce Hitler's zookeeper. She plays sort of a passive character, and her character is a bit one note, especially compared to what was that movie she was in last year?
Miss
she was a lobbyist.
Sloan?
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought that character was kind of one note too, but it was two totally different notes.
But her hair had depth.
Yeah.
In that movie. Oh my gosh.
But I just feel it's really well made, but if you're looking to see the zoo, you know, it's only a zoo for about the first 15 minutes. Then it becomes a hog farm, so it should have, I guess, the hog farmer's wife or something like
sure.
that.
Sure. Not quite as sexy there, that title.
Yeah, no doubt. I just feel like I've seen this story before, you know, the noble do-gooder who hides the Jews from the Nazis, et cetera, et cetera. It's also PG-13, so it's, you know, most Holocaust movies are rated R because they want to illustrate this, you know, the sadism of the Nazis. This one, the Nazis are kind of dumb. I mean, the husband's like sneaking these Jews out the front door right past these Nazis, and these Nazis go, hey, what are you doing with that Jew? And he goes, oh, he's a doctor. He's a doctor. We need to help him save some Nazis or so. Oh, okay. The Nazis come off as kind of dumb, but it's an okay movie.
We're a little bit smarter than Hogan's Heroes.
Yeah, a little bit.
I like to imagine the pitch to the studio head. It's like, okay, it's Schindler's List meets We Bought a Zoo.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa!
Schindler's Zoo.
Jessica
Chastain.
All right, Chastain.
So I will be reviewing, I will be reviewing The Zookeeper's Wife, so look for my review a week from Thursday. How about a quick review of Sense of an Ending, Jim?
Oh, Sense of an Ending is sort of a British comedy drama. Jim Broadbent is this fellow in modern day London. He's got a used camera shop. He's got a 30-year-old daughter that's about to give birth. He's divorced, and he starts thinking about his time in college 50 years previous, especially when he gets a registered letter saying that the mother of his college sweetheart has willed him a diary, and the diary is of one of his classmates who, you know, killed himself. And it's just a lot of it's kind of dull. If you're a big fans of Broadbent, they're selling it as a show.
The title is dull.
It's kind of generic. Charlotte Rampling is being sold as the star of it, but she's got a very small supporting part in it.
So it should be called Sense of When is the Ending Coming?
Yes, it's bouncing back between 66 and in 2016 quite a bit, and it's wanting to unravel this mystery, and they're hiding things from the viewer, and it's not as clever as it thinks it
and
is.
Did you review that movie?
No, Kate did. Kate liked it more than me. I think she might have given it 3.5.
Oh, Kate always likes those kind of movies.
But this, you know, if you liked 45 Years from last year, you would probably enjoy this.
I like 45 Years. Well, that's a good movie.
But that's a better film than this one. Okay. I mean, it's along the same lines of thinking about the past and uncovering hidden secrets from the past.
Charlotte.
And Emily Mortimer plays the mother that had willed it, the diary, and she's kind of a vivacious Mrs. Robinson type, and there's a flirtation going on. Yeah. And I don't know, it's kind of just middle of the road. It's one of those films to watch on a rainy afternoon.
Yeah. How many stars would you give it?
I would probably have given it 2.5 or 3.
Jim nearly didn't like Sense of an Ending too much, but it's not the worst thing in the world. What are we seeing this week? Trainspotting opens Friday, but I guess they're not showing that to us. That's actually getting pretty good reviews. I don't know.
Why are they not showing that to critics? That's a big deal. Yeah,
I know.
It should be. And then what are we seeing? Wilson? Is that the one we're seeing?
Yeah. Seeing Wilson tonight, Wednesday night.
Yeah.
It's not the biopic of Woodrow Wilson.
No, that was a big flop. But Vincent Price was in that.
Daniel Clowes wrote the graphic novel. This is based on, and I love Ghost World, which is coming out on Criterion Blu-ray soon.
All right. Then Wednesday night, there's screenings of Saban's Power Rangers, which none of us are going to, and Life. I can't go, though. Life looks pretty interesting. It's actually, I looked at the Rotten Tomatoes, it's at 100% with about 6 reviews.
Doesn't, that's kind of a generic title, too. Yeah, and, you know, it kind of strikes me as like an alien riff or something.
100%. Yeah, Armand White has not gotten to it yet, obviously.
But you know darn well Beauty and the Beast will still be number one next week. So it doesn't really matter what's opening. All right, let's talk about some local stuff. I went to the French Film Festival last night and saw the one about the donkey. Hazard Baltazar.
Which I'll just interject. I have not seen the film, but at Zeek Film, we have a section for classic French cinema. It's right there on the front page, ZeekFilm.org. One of our writers in LA, Robert Hornack, has been writing about this. He just did a piece, a great piece about that film.
Did you get it up before they showed it at Webster?
Well, you know, it's there. people can read the piece.
It's considered a classic. I had never seen it before. It was interesting. There was a 35mm print, too.
Is that a silent film or early?
Silent film, but it's 50s.
It's about a donkey.
Yeah, it's about a donkey. It's kind of, you know, Todd Solondz said he was inspired when he made Wiener Dog by old Hazard Balthazar. And that's very similar.
Yes.
It's about a donkey who goes from owner to owner, and he's mistreated, and he's a circus donkey, and he has all these adventures. But it's really about the miserable lives of the people that
own it's sort of an anthology thing with the donkeys, the unifying.
Yeah, Saturday night they showed a 35mm print of Last Year at Marienbad. I didn't go because I took my family to see Beauty and the Beast. But Pete Timmerman said that print was in terrible shape.
Ooh.
He said they couldn't get it to focus. And,
no.
It just looked like crap.
I almost went to that.
Oh, yeah.
Because I haven't seen the movie.
The print last night looked fine. Those are the only two prints they had. Everything else is going to be digital.
Blu-ray.
And this weekend, Day for Night, Francois Truffaut's Day for Night, and that will be hosted and introduced and discussed by my friend Renee Hirschfeld. And then Saturday night is Eyes Without a Face, a George Frenzy's horror film, which I used to own a 16mm print of, and it was dubbed, and it was called Horror Chamber of Dr. Faustus, and it was cut, too. But this is the French version, of course. And that will be introduced by Andrew Wyatt from the St. Louis Film Critics Association.
Yay!
That's Saturday night at 7:30. And then Sunday night is a movie I'm totally unfamiliar with called Paris Belongs to Us.
It's Jacques Rivette. His first film right before the French New Wave really blew up. Some people credit it as the first French New Wave film, but not really. Anyway,
And that is introduced by our fellow film critic friend, Robert Hunt, I think.
He's the right guy for that.
Okay, yeah, he is. Also, Dead and Buried. You guys ever seen Dead and Buried?
I haven't.
That's excellent.
I need to.
Actually, I read the book first.
There was a paperback
adaptation.
Well, it was written by Dan O'Bannon, who's a St. Louis native, and kind of written between Alien and Return of the Living Dead. It's really good. It's kind of a thinking man's zombie film. And it also has a really cool sort of Twilight Zone-esque twist at the end. That's midnight, Friday and Saturday at The Moolah is part of the Late Night Grindhouse. You ever been to the Late Night Grindhouse?
Many years ago, I realized that at this phase of life, midnight movies are not an option for me any longer. Yeah. It was just a waste of time and money. I took a nap. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And I want to. You know, it sounds so much fun.
I've fallen asleep once or twice, but I never miss Late Night Grindhouse. But I know what you mean.
Yeah. I'll get back around to it later in life, I think.
Yes.
All right. Let's see. Other local things. Our fellow film critic Diane Carson did this documentary called Other People's Footage.
Mm-hmm.
And she's done a good job of getting it shown around town. They're showing it again on the 27th, which I guess is a week from tonight.
Yeah.
At the RAC, which is a Regional Arts Commission building at 6128 Del Mar, starting at 6:30. And it costs $10. It must be a fundraiser.
I think it's with Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts, which is a great organization. They really helped us a lot with Zeke Film.
Okay, good.
Oh,
and nice. A Streetcar Named Desire is showing next Sunday night in Brown Hall on the campus of Washington University, and that is part of the Tennessee Williams birthday. I guess they're going to do that every year. We should do the Vincent Price birthday every year. They're going to do the Tennessee Williams birthday every year.
Yeah, I passed by there. They got an African Film Festival coming up very
soon,
too.
That's a thing.
I put an article about that. And they're showing 1984 at the St. Louis County Library on April 4th. And they're showing that all across the country. All these people are getting together to show 1984 because, you know, with Trump in office now, we live in this total totalitarian system where Donald Trump is strapping cages with rats on people's faces. And they're going to have some sort of post-discussion reactionary pity party after that. I would love to be a fly on the wall for that. But that is the same
night. I'm glad you don't editorialize, Tom.
It's my 16mm double feature night, so don't see 1984. Although it's a good movie. I do recommend it.
Is it good?
And it's got we just lost John Hurt, and it's got one of his, you know, central performances, and is the very last performance of Richard Burton.
It is
a good movie.
But don't go.
Go to the Way Out Club that night, which is April 4th, and see First Blood and Smokey and the Bandit. I guess that's it for
the anti-1984
local stuff. Oh no, that's not the local stuff.
No.
We're going to run out of time. Let me talk about the midnight show. The midnight shows, which start next weekend at the Tivoli. I host the midnight show at the Tivoli every Friday night. Except I don't do Rocky Horror Picture Show because they have their own crew, and that's the first one, March 31st and April 1st. April 7th and 8th is The Drunken Master.
That's a lot of fun.
But I'm not sure. You know, there was The Drunken Master in 1978, which is one of his kung fu movies.
Sure.
But then in 1994, they made The Legend of the Drunken Master, and that was when he was... You know, that was right after a Rumble in the Bronx.
We're talking about Jackie Chan.
Yeah, and I'm not sure which one of their... It makes more sense for them to show Legend of the Drunken Master. And that was sort of an epic, and it was sort of a Western, and it had some sequences on trains, and it was a big budget thing.
Well, they can show whatever they want.
Well, I know. I'm just not sure which one they're showing. It makes more sense to show the later one. But the picture in the ad on their flyers from the 1978 version.
Mm-hmm.
But I have the feeling that it's the 1994 version, but I could be wrong. Idiocracy is April 14th and 15th. Shaun of the Dead, April 21st and 22nd. 2001, A Space Odyssey, April 28th and 29th. Gremlins, May 5th and May 6th. My Neighbor Totoro, which is a Miyazaki. Last time we showed a Miyazaki, we were like sold out.
Oh, wow. The Midnight?
The Miyazakis are just attendance insurance.
Oh, wow.
That's May 12th and 13th. And May 19th and 20th is The Dark Knight. That's all at the Tivoli Theater, 6350 Del Mar. Jim Tudor reviews Blu-rays for... You review Blu-rays for both of the sites you write for?
Mostly Zeke Film, I'll throw the occasional Blu-ray over to Screen Anarchy. I actually just posted a review for Criterion's release of a Mexican horror documentary experimental, Canoa.
I love Canoa.
Canoa,
did
a
you like
shameful
it?
Memory. I didn't love it, Tom. I respect it more than I like it. It does play, as you told me before I watched it plays like a horror film where these students go... go to this town to go on a hike, and of course everybody there thinks they're communists, so they must die.
The priest tells the villagers that these students are going to paint the church red. So the villagers grab their pitchforks and their torches and go after these poor college students. It's pretty shocking.
Apparently it made quite the mark on the culture of its time, but I don't know. I reviewed that one, and I love Criterion's work. I'm a big
now, what
supporter
kind of extras
there.
Do they have in that?
Not much. It's a 1 hour long conversation between Alfonso Cuarón, the director of like Gravity and Children of Men. Okay, so it's him and then the director of this film, a guy named I believe Philip Cazal, and they talk for 1 hour, and it's a very good conversation. Mm-hmm. And then there is a 3-minute dealio with Guillermo del Toro just talking to the camera about how much he loves Canoa. Yeah, okay. So Canoa, there's your lofty pick. And
Speaking of Alfonso Cuarón, I rented over the weekend Desierto. Do you see? Remember seeing previews for that with Jeffrey Dean Morgan?
No.
And he's hunting Mexicans in the desert. They're gonna try to cross over the border in the U.S. And that was directed by Alfonso Cuarón's son.
Yes.
And I thought it was going to play at the theaters, but it didn't. I saw it in the red box, so I rented it. It's not very good. It's good for like the first half, and then you think, then it's just sadistic, and all it is this guy hunting these Mexicans and shooting them.
Well,
but I watch a lot of Blu-rays and I buy a lot of Blu-rays, but I don't really review them for Weird Movie Geek because I get so busy with the news stories and things like that.
We don't do news.
But I love Blu-rays and especially Blu-rays from the 60s and 70s and 80s. We talked about the Kino Lorber label.
Oh my gosh!
And
I love
just,
them.
I do too. Just they just come out with the best titles.
Good people there.
Yeah.
So
what else have you reviewed from the Kino Lorber label lately?
Well, I brought a pile in, actually, guys. You want to take a look at
hold them up to the microphone.
Yeah,
hold
it here.
Such great radio.
Yeah, you can go to look these up on my site.
Yeah, you've got The Bitch here with
Joan Collins.
She made a series of these. It was The Stud, The Bitch, The Bastard.
No. I think it was just those two, right?
She wouldn't do...
See, I've
so
never...
She stopped. But they were based on novels that were written by her sister.
Yes. Jackie Collins.
Did you listen to the audio commentary by David Del Valle?
Okay. It's good.
I like David Del Valle's commentary.
Here's the thing about that movie, The Bitch. It is the follow-up to The Stud, and they talk about this. I have not seen The Stud. The Stud came out the same day, a couple weeks ago, as this one did.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to send me both, and they only sent me the second one. So I'm like, well, what do? Do I watch it? The deadline was coming up. I figured, what the heck, I'll just watch it. So I watched this movie. It is like, 50 Shades of Grey level, torrid, and just rich people,
doing
terrible things and backstabbing each other and screwing each other. And
That's what all those Jackie Collins books were. I used to actually read those.
It has some fantastic production value. I mean, you think, wow, this is just a laughable piece of trash. And Joan Collins in this movie, it's 1979, and she owns a disco club. And everything's all about the big disco club and the scenes of everyone disco dancing. No one in this movie can dance. It is they're standing there like they have to go pee, And it's really funny. It's
I'm sure they weren't dancing to the soundtrack that they eventually use in the film. So,
they keep using the same song, the theme song, which is actually pretty catchy. That drops like five times throughout the movie. This movie was a riot, if you're into this sort of thing.
Yeah. So what does David Del Valle say in his commentary?
Oh, a lot of the things I just said. I ripped him off. No, I'm kidding. They say, they give a good history of why. They're big Joan Collins fans. I guess they met her. And they talk about why she did the movie.
David knows everybody. That's why I love his commentary so much. I'm sure he does research and comes prepared, but he doesn't come off that way. He just seems like he's himself, and he's talking. He knows all these people. I know David. He came in town for Vincent Daniel, and I had dinner with him.
Oh, great.
Right during – that was – we had all those horrible tornadoes.
Oh.
And actually, in his commentary on House of a Thousand Dolls with the Vincent Price movie, he talks about coming to St. Louis for Vincent Daniel and being terrified of these tornadoes. And he goes, what was that? What the hell was I doing in St. Louis?
Yeah.
But he – he's been around forever. I think he's one of the ultimate living film historians, David Del Valle.
Yeah, and he's on here with Nick Redman, too, who's also very good and knowledgeable. And that's the great thing about, Kino Lorber started putting these commentary tracks. The commentary track is a dying thing in the Blu-ray and DVD market. You don't get as many of them anymore. The studios are backing off of it.
I listen to them all the time.
I love them.
Oh, yeah.
And, but the strange thing is, Kino put out a prestige title, which is the Leos Carax 1991 French film Lovers on the Bridge. And I have that right here. It's Juliette Binoche and Denis Levant.
Yeah,
and
I saw this, that at the front there.
Yeah, this
black and white.
I've not. Oh no, it's not. It's not? It's very color. Yeah,
sure?
And it's yeah, man. I watched it. I reviewed it. Oh. So you go to Zeke.
Well, you
Film
must have seen the colorized version.
You can read my review. The Lovers on the Bridge, 1991, classic French cinema. Anyhow, this movie, they don't have a commentary on it, which it's begging for one. We got a commentary on The Bitch, and we got commentaries on some of these others I have here. But I don't know. Anyway, this is a great Blu-ray, by the way, The Lovers on the Bridge. It's something every film buff will want to own because it's a overlooked.
Yeah, you reviewed gem. A couple weeks ago, reviewed Dr. Orloff's Monster.
Yes, I did.
And you talked about Tim Lucas's commentary. I think Tim Lucas is my favorite commentarian. Is that a word? It is now.
Yeah.
I go out of my way to listen to Tim Lucas's commentaries, and I'll buy any Blu-ray. In fact, just in the past 2 weeks, I've listened to Orloff's Monsters, well, his 1 Million Years B.C. commentary.
Destiny?
Just last week. Yeah, Destiny. I bought that. Just last week, I got The Skull with Cushing and Christopher Lee.
Yeah.
He does the commentary on that.
He
stopped doing video. Watchdog magazine.
I know.
Which is unfortunate, but he's just been really ramping up the commentaries. What did you think of his commentary for Dr. Orloff's Monster?
I thought it was fine. You know, I really appreciate his depth of knowledge and his enthusiasm for the genre and whatnot. His commentaries sometimes can get a little dry and academic, but I don't mind because, you know, like I said, it's worth it. And the fact that he's doing what he does, and these other commentators as well. I imagine they're probably not earning a whole lot, if anything, from doing this. So I my hat is off to them. I really think it's fantastic.
Steve Haberman is another really good commentarian. He's done a lot. He's kind of been the go-to guy for Vincent Price films on those Vincent Price box sets. He does most of the commentaries on those. Tom Weaver is another good commentarian. He does 50s monster movies. He just knows everything.
He really does.
Tim is the best. I mean, Tim not only researches, but he sees things in films that most people don't.
Huh.
And it's just amazing. There's another commentarian I don't like, Christopher Alexander. He was the editor of Fangoria magazine.
Oh.
And I saw a commentary he did. I think it was The Curse of the Faceless Man or something. He goes, I don't research my commentaries. I look at commentaries like freeform jazz. So I just show up and whatever comes off the top of my head, I'll say. But then he's going, this actor, I can't think of his name, but he was in that movie. Oh, I can't think of the name of that movie. Well, if you're going to be a film historian, come prepared with some film history, pal.
Did you ever hear about
terrible.
The time back in the golden age of DVDs? I think it was... You know, back when Lionsgate was Artisan and they gave Arnold Schwarzenegger like a big amount of money to come in and do commentary for Total Recall. And it was just a whole lot of him going, there's that guy I know. Yeah. And I have that belt. You know, I kept that belt.
Actor commentaries are always terrible. I stopped listening to actor commentaries a long time ago.
Oh.
I can think of two exceptions, though. Jack Nicholson's commentary on The Passenger is amazing.
Yes.
It's the best actor commentary I've ever listened to, and Malcolm McDowell's commentary on Clockwork Orange. Really fascinating.
Yeah.
But I hear the Sideways commentary is very good. The one with Paul
Giamatti
and Thomas Hayden Church.
Yeah, that's a good one. And even director commentaries I don't really like anymore.
Yeah.
They're just... Tim Burton, who you think would be fascinating, he's terrible.
He
puts
really
you to sleep.
He puts himself to sleep. It's terrible.
Yeah.
But I tell you, the Russo brothers and the screenwriters of Civil War were very good on their commentary track, by the way.
Yeah. So it's great. You know, Kino's keeping the commentary alive of Certain Fury. This is another one
I'm borrowing that one from you.
This is a fun commentary. It's 1985.
Yeah.
It's two girls on the run. It's Tatum O'Neill and Irene Cara. They're framed. They're blamed. Everyone thinks it's them because there's another white girl and a black girl in a courtroom. They shoot up the place in the first 5 minutes. And then Tatum O'Neill and Irene Cara, who are white and black and the same age, run out in the chaos. And everybody thinks it was them.
Mm-hmm.
The chase is on throughout the whole movie. And my gosh, it is like so urban. There is like trash, piles of trash everywhere they go. It's filthy in this movie.
I haven't seen that in 30 years. I'm looking forward to borrowing that.
Yeah, this this the one. It's just, you know, great cover too.
Whatever to Irene Cara.
Just screams VHS. Irene Cara is still alive.
Oh, I know she's still alive.
Her fame did not live forever.
Tatum O'Neill is the Oscar winner, and her performance in this is a strange movie. It's like I was watching it, and I was like, what is Tatum O'Neill doing? She's like very Baroque here, but the next day it was her that stuck in my mind, even though Irene Cara gives the more sensible performance. So hey, you know, that's Certain Fury is the name of the movie.
Peter Fonda.
And it is new on Blu-ray. Thank you, Kino.
Exciting.
So I've got a few others here. Last night I watched this film called September Storm, this is from 1960.
Does it say 3D on it?
It is. Yeah. It says 3D on it no less than four times on the cover.
Oh, yeah.
3D. It's reminding you that this is a 3D
movie. Do you have a 3D
movie.
TV?
I don't. So I can't.
Yeah.
Do you?
I don't, but a friend of mine does. And every time I'm kind of blown away by the depth of 3D television sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, the House of Wax and Creatures from the Black Lagoon are fantastic.
And the Mad Magician. The ones, Mad Max.
I don't
Fury
have
Road.
One, but my brother has one.
Yeah, I've watched 3D TV.
So we'll need to take this disc of September Storm over there. Apparently, there's an outfit known as the 3D Film Archive. They did a Kickstarter, which I only know about because the end credits of the Blu-ray here has a roll of people who gave money to restore this piece of junk. This movie,
not a good movie.
Awful.
It looks exciting. It's got a shark chasing a gal on the cover.
No, Joanne Drew is the lead here. She's as good as can be in this movie. She's surrounded by three lugs, and they're looking for treasure out in the sea. And again, it's 1960. Boy, nothing happens. And it's just, you know, I just don't know what to say. The cover with her in the bikini getting chased by a shark is a lot better. This never happens in the movie. She never wears this. This scene does not occur. You know, it's really poorly done, and I don't know why. I mean, my thoughts on film restoration, it's like great to have anything restored. But on the other hand, if people are going to throw money at a Kickstarter to save an old movie, maybe we could consider Orson Welles' Other Side of the Wind, anybody? You know? I don't know. This one.
But I'm sure somebody thinks that's a great movie.
That's probably something. Apparently. Anyway, you can look at that.
Well, whoever has the rights to it thinks that.
Now, I've got another piece of trash from the 1980s called They're Playing with Fire. Sybil Danning.
Well, that was a private Lessons knockoff. That was a huge hit with Sylvia Christel, and then there was all these you know, cougar
my tutor
hot for teacher.
yeah
this movie, it's the cover is her in this, you know, it's the blue dress she wears in the movie. They made it look white on the cover of this Blu-ray, and this boy staring at her like he can't believe it, like, holy cow, what? You know, like, she just appeared and she's got her leg up and he's, you know, probably looking.
Sybil Danning was hot stuff. I met Sybil Danning once.
Have
you ever read
did.
About how her manager ruined her career?
No.
There's a whole chapter on it in David DelVal's book called The Hollywood Sign, and this guy was just crazy, and he would take her to parties. And then he would like want to charge people to get her autograph, you know, at parties where they're supposed to be mingling and making connections. And eventually this guy was murdered by the mafia. This guy was just so obnoxious.
Jeez.
But by that time, her career just had sunk.
Have you seen her now?
I met her maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago.
She's on the disc doing an interview that was recorded recently.
Yeah. She looked pretty rough.
It's downright odd. She looks younger now.
Well, she was in the Halloween remake, wasn't
that's
she?
Right.
That,
that's
she's
right.
been in a couple of Rob Zombie
Rob Zombie
things.
Likes to trot her out.
And she's not as tall. I mean, they always make her out like some big Amazon, but she's not a tall woman at all. She's like 5'6".
This movie, it starts off as what you're saying, one of those hot for teacher kind of, you know, and then it veers into other genres. Like it wants to be a noir, but this boy in this movie is horrible. He cannot act.
Did you review that one already?
I did. I just posted the review for They're Playing with Fire on ZekeFilm.org.
I'll have to go home and read that. But I'm going to borrow that one, too.
I just posted that review yesterday.
That's what happens if you bring blues, you got to lend them to me.
Yeah, oh my gosh. Yeah, I know. That's I run the risk here. But, it's a piece of trash that kind of defeated me.
Yeah. And what else do you have coming
Deluge.
Up?
Deluge. Have you seen Deluge?
Deluge? No.
This looks like a 30s thing.
It is.
40s?
And it's got some epic destruction scenes.
It is. It's 1933. And this was a lost movie that I had never heard of. And it's great scenes of cities being destroyed.
Yeah.
They're like in miniature.
Yeah.
And it's like in the first 15 minutes of the movie, there's like a global catastrophe of some sort, a natural disaster, and everything is leveled. And
is it pretty good though?
Yeah, well, it's it turns into a melodrama.
Yeah.
And I recommend it because it does get it becomes about this girl, and she's very attractive. Apparently, the actress has a tragic backstory of her own.
Yeah.
Died in 1940. Anyhow, this female character can't catch a break. There's a man, the main guy in the movie, his family has died in the catastrophe. The performances are not particularly great, but their presence is good.
Edward Van Sloan is in it.
For 1 second.
Oh, really?
We're going to have to wrap up because we're running out of time. What are you reviewing coming up in the next couple weeks on Blu-ray? Do you know?
No.
No, you don't know. Okay,
The stud, hopefully.
All right, Jim Batts wants to say brief words on a couple of people who died. They weren't really movie people, but they're worthy of a couple of brief words. Jim?
Now, of course, the great Chuck Berry, a St. Louis icon, a rock and roll legend. I would say try to catch him playing himself in Rock, 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 and especially the Hail, Hail Rock and Roll movie, the documentary that was shot at the Fox is terrific.
Yeah,
and the great Bernie Wrightson, probably best known as the co-creator of Swamp Thing, and of course there were two movies based on that character.
Yeah.
He did the graphic novel adaptation of Creepshow. Silver Bullet is based on Cycle the Werewolf we worked on. Mm. Terrific artist, gone way too soon at 68.
All right, so RIP to Chuck and Bernie. We're going to have to wrap this up. We'll be back next weekend, or 2 weeks. We'll be back in 2 weeks because I have spring break next week. Renee Hirschfeld's going to join us in the studio. She is going to the Turner Classic Movies Film Festival in L.A., so she'll come back and talk all about that, and we'll review some other new movies. But for now, I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Jim Tudor.
Thanks for joining us, Jim Tudor, and be sure to listen again in 2 weeks for the We Are Movie Geeks podcast.
Black leather, rock, rock, rock. Black leather, ta, ta, ta. Black leather,
Oh, naughty, stife.